Hello and welcome to Benyo Chats, my personal podcast. If you're curious about the world, this show is for you. On this episode, I speak to Tassos Stevens. We discuss how Tassos is thinking about theatre making, his artistic practice, and advice for others. If you enjoy the show, please like and subscribe as it helps others find the podcast. Thank you. Hey everyone, I'm super excited to be speaking with Tassos Stevens. Tassos has been making theatre and games for over 20 years and is the artistic director of Coney. He's one of the most creative and brilliant theatre and playmakers I know. So Tassos, welcome.
Thanks, Ben. Yeah, nice to be here.
Over 20 years or so, we've collaborated on and off, and most lately I've been chair of Coney for the last 10 years and have rotated off in line with good governance. And I think you were one of the first people I worked with in this collaborative centric view of theatre making, as opposed to a kind of writer or director as the central nexus over how theatre making or playmaking should be. And if I think back over the last 20 years, you've had these two threads of, for want of a better word, the kind of playwright or maybe a director as the center of theater, or a more collaborative or playmaking or ensemble styles of theater. And I was interested in your reflections of how you've worked over the last 20 years. What's drawn you to one or other of those threads, or how have they developed?
Yeah, I guess partly I found myself drawn like away from like the idea of like making plays, making like script-led work, and more towards making like the kind of play where an audience can take part or play if they choose, which exemplifies Coney. And then like the very different demands of making work like that, I think also like really lend themselves to something which is much more kind of collaborative, because you can't, you don't know exactly what's going to happen until like you have an audience like to play it. Like you can't be sure. And there's levels of uncertainty kind of inside that, and levels of like, you know, areas where you don't have, you know, control necessarily as a maker, which almost then by definition means that like a singular vision is like much, yeah, it's just not a particularly good way of working, I think, with this kind of work, and how important it is to have like different perspectives to bounce off, like kind of inside that process, as well as being more fun. Like, you know, you know, where you as makers actually kind of enjoying yourself, like, and all the times I've enjoyed myself the most in a room, it's been with other people, and it's been with a sense of like, yeah, we're all kind of like, we've all got a common purpose and like, and direction that has emerged, but we're also all free to sort of like, as much as far as possible, to like be playing with what's interesting us, like, and be playing together. And yeah, that's, yeah, I think to be guided by that is important.
And you've used a few times this concept of play, which I think is maybe a little bit of a concept worth exploring a little bit, because you've worked with the great Bernie de Koven Blue previously, kind of on games and that kind of playing, and also how this world of play has interacted with your theatre making, creative making, or play making. How's that evolved, I guess, over the last couple of decades in terms of your thinking about how to make creative work?
It's still evolving. Like, I'm actually like at the moment just reading on Kindle like book I should have read like 10 years ago by Pat Kane called The Play Ethic, which is a really useful distillation, like different theories of like what play means. I use play as a kind of a catch-all, like, yeah, nouns are tricky always, because it's tricky to be, because like a noun formats, like, I think we think about kind of experiences in terms of like, in terms of the format, what will that ask of me? So we think of going to the cinema, like in terms of like, gonna go sit in big comfy seats, like have some snacks. The kind of the film kind of unfolds, like, you know, you kind of it happens for the duration, then you can like you know what's asked of you in going to the cinema, like and you know what I mean by that noun cinema, and it might flex a little bit, but it's like it. But where we're the kind of play that Coney makes, the formats are always like varying. Like we're potentially changing everything at each point, and it's kind of. But I found that play feels the sort of the best catch. In part inspired by a friend of mine, Paul Bannon, like saying in jest, like back 2008, yeah, it's all play in it. And I mean, I briefly had a website called All Play All because All Play was not available. That was, kind of like riffing off that. And then find, and I think really broadly, it's like define it as anything that people can take part in and play, but it's a sense of like, yeah, the kind of the playing audience, as I refer now, is like it's the more active it's. I think the relation between games and play in terms of a kind of game theorist is kind of super interesting. I think there's something, and certainly kind of my inspiration with any conversations with Bernie de Koven, who I can, I often like kind of dub my Jedi Master. Like it kind of it has felt like that kind of relationship. The sort of what the time that I spent with him, the exchange I had with him, really sort of opened up was the idea that thinking about kind of a game as like some thinking about as if it's an object. I'm gonna hold up. Here's a little kind of like bit of kind of curious glassware made for me by a friend. If this is like the game that that we are playing, we will change the way that we play this game in order to be able to kind of keep playing well together. If we are more important than the game, then that's what happens. And like kind of in contrast to say professional sports, the game is kind of like the most important thing, unless it kind of comes like life or death. So the game will not be changed. But here, we will change this because we want to, because ultimately like our relationship and how we're playing together is the most important thing. And you have this kind of like, it's a loose, it gives a loose structure, the game, but then in some ways the real play is then the negotiation that happens between us as, how are we going to play? Like, and what's going on in the room, like between us and beyond. And that sort of, so I think about it like that in terms of that, the sort of the flexing and fluxing of like the loose structure, whatever that might be, but being negotiated always by the people who are playing. I think, play philosophically is also like the kind of, it's also imagining like, what if, like it's kind of, it's pretending, it's make-believe. Like, and I prefer like make belief or performing belief rather than suspending disbelief, as we kind of would see like in a theatrical sense. But always at the same time, remembering what is really there. Like, and in some ways then the meaning like arises between that, like, the what if and the what is in that respect as we're playing. And that's true. That's true of all play, like even going to the theatre.
And another word in your, initial answer, which seems intersectional with that, is this idea of interactive. So actions have consequences for both audience and players, say all players when the audience are players. So I think it's very interesting that this interactive work with this, and that it's very satisfying to see your own actions or actions where you're part of the play have those consequences. Is that an important piece of your thinking and making at the moment?
Always. I think that it's although like it's also important to sort of note that there'll be different kind of models of play, like, and each there'll be different interactive models, like, and each one is different, and it's not that one is necessarily better or worse, like, as long as rather that each one kind of also kind of carries meaning, like there's dramaturgy to the interactive structure as much as there is to the kind of like the story that it might be telling, kind of inside that. So it's perfectly possible to have a yeah, a piece of meaningful play where the consequences to your actions might be obscured, because that's the point. Like, but yeah, it being the point would be, yeah, what makes that meaningful. But yeah, otherwise, like broadly, I think that there's something of that sort of like active, yeah, the activation and the sense of agency, the perception of agency that like the good play gives to people. And I don't mean by perception of agency that it is necessarily like a fake perception, but it's the, you know, but that's the thing ultimately that kind of gives derived satisfaction, but as well as like the potential for connection between people that like good play can spark, as well as the kind of the sense of like one's, yeah, the things that we're doing that we're good at or enjoy doing. And I was kind of, I use like the term talents to slightly loosely to define that things that we do, especially things we do that we enjoy, but we also might be good at, and that those, you know, how those get like reflected and discovered through play as well. I think that's a lot what's in play and that makes something like meaningful and impactful.
Sure. Yes. That sense of that agency for sure. And another strand of your work and Coney's work seems to be, to use the word immersive, I guess, suggesting that the audience are present in the world of play, but not necessarily in sort of the big takeover, although it could be the big takeover of a building and you create a whole new world and they're in that world, but even in a sort of smaller sense, whether it's potentially almost one-on-one play or that world, but present in this world. And my reflection is that's been quite an important strand and a very fruitful strand of sort of artistic practice, both for yourself and Coney and for where actually performing arts has got to. Do you think how important is immersive, or at least this sense of presence in the world?
I would like echo the kind of the little definition that you offered there. Like, I think that, I mean, and I teach quite often, and like as part of sort of like teaching, yeah, offer these like little working definitions that I find useful of like immersive and interactive. And the definition of immersive of like the audience is present in the world of the piece, in the, you know, in the world of the play. And they might have a role in that as well. That role might also be simply as the audience. They might have actions that they do, which, you know, may have, you know, kind of consequence like for their own experience or for the overall like outcome. It's kind of towards interactivity. Those actions might also simply be, you know, those spectating, of listening and watching, like, but they must be present in order for, but I think it's kind of crucial for this work. And also like immersive has become a buzzword, like in terms of like, a particular kind of experience, like probably like, yeah, sort of imagining like the kind of the punch drunk model of a massed audience, like moving through in a, you know, a very detailed sort of like almost like cinematic level of like, you know, realization of like of an environment where they might then like interact with performers like along the way of that. And it doesn't have to be like that. Because I also think in that, using that definition, like even like as old a form of storytelling, which I've also been really interested in, and I've also like explored like more outside of Coney until recently, like in a piece made over the pandemic, kind of brought those two things together. And with storytelling, like the audience is present, it's very present for the storyteller at every point.
You have to bring them into the world to be successful as a storyteller.
Yeah, very, very, very often. And it's, you know, quite literally that you're doing that in order to. I would kind of resist any idea that this is like it is a new thing. Just we're addressing it differently, but it's.
And to maybe extend that, I mean, a word we've used in our discussions has been the experience of a play or a piece of theatre. But I kind of think that when we think about immersion, yes, we've, as you say, brought it to this world, but actually the immersion in a piece of creative work or the experience of that work continues really for as long as it lives in our minds and discussion. which actually is in some ways is the fully extended piece of where immersion is. And I think of work that we did, you know, 20 years ago, or some work we did on, I come back to the pub quiz or quizzing type of work that you've done, which actually has now lived with me for a very long time as a form of experience and a form of thinking about how we interact with the world. So I know you've had some reflections about, you know, when a piece of work begins, sort of as you hear about it or think about it, and where it ends, which can in some way be kind of almost never, or at least so far for me, some of the work that we've done, it hasn't ended yet. It may not ever even be played again, but there is something to that. And I was wondering if you've been thinking about that more of late, also going digital, online, this things, but this idea of it just lasts a long time with you.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it's the thing, I joke, it's the thing I most often get quoted to saying, that the experience of anything begins when you first hear about it, ends when you stop thinking or talking about it. And it also that, I mean, like from the earliest days of Kony, like we were sort of like considering an event, like breaking it down into at least like three phases. Like, you might have the play, like, you know, what happens if the experience is going to the theatre, what happens like after the curtain raises, like before it drops again. And then everything that happens in advance of that, we kind of call the events. And this is the space also occupied by marketing. And then everything that happens afterwards is kind of called the tale, like the tale of a rabbit. I think it's kind of true also that I think one of the sort of the things that Kony was playing with quite early on was particularly with the events and what you can do here in terms of being able to bring an audience also, both literally to the play, in as much as that if it is happening somewhere other than like, a building, like how we could like kind of bring people that's a piece like Adventure One to like a secret location somewhere in the city of London, but also imaginatively, and also to be ready for that, and also being able to play with like the sense of like people's anticipations and expectations and what happens here. But I think I'm becoming more and more interested with the tale and what happens afterwards, and also, I mean, and that's something that will happen quite organically, like, you know, because then, you know, our memories might be triggered by bumping, you know, going past a place where you played, or, you know, you pick up a program, or it's usually more around like a physical tangible object, or bumping into somebody. And actually one of my favorite little stories around like a Kony piece of Small Town Anywhere, which you made like, you know, an eon ago, like, you know, 12 years ago, was like, I think the kind of the sort of the first finished version was like released at Battersea Arts Centre. And actually from a scratch phase of that, I don't think you'll mind me saying, the Guardian critic Lynn Gardner came to play, and she was the postmistress in Small Town, as you know, Ben, but to explain to, like, you know, basically an audience, playing audience of around 30 are the citizens of a small town, but invited by the historian of the town to recreate the most momentous week in the town's history. And it's an adaptation, very free adaptation of the film Le Corbeau by Henri-Georges Clouzot, aka The Raven. And mimics like kind of within the storyline of the film, like the fact that there is, you know, somebody like who signs themselves the Raven, who in this town in like 1940s-esque France, like knows all the secrets of the citizens and is like busy trying to destroy the town by basically like writing poison pen letters signed the Raven to circulate this. And we took that and then kind of like adapted it into what I, in a nutshell, would say is that kind of parable about the rise of fascism. But so within this, and, you know, and in the play of it, like gossip was the thing that like everybody in the town does. And they can do that in conversation, but there's also like a postal service and maybe people write letters to each other. Like, so Lynn Gardner, brilliant like theatre critic, at that time of The Guardian, comes to play the scratch. She's La Postmistress, she's written a secret in the advance, which is that I think that she killed her baby and buried its body beneath a juniper tree. And we take that she's kind of created and break that up into like various like fragments of gossip, which we then like seed amongst the other citizens of the town, along with stuff around the other secrets. And then, yeah, basically stirring the pot, gossip starts to rise. The Raven knows everything, is trying to like sort of like kind of put stuff kind of as well. And there's a real risk. The way that it went, there was potential, like if you ended up being scapegoated, you could literally be executed by the end of it, like with the kind of threat that's put by a new fascist state against the town. So anyway, lots to play for. Lynn plays like a devil in that she takes advantage of her job to basically destroy all the post that's coming in. She opens the letters, reads them, and then literally tears up and throws away anything that refers to her secret. And also, when the kind of suspicion kind of starts pointing at her more directly, she's like, oh no, that's like that's not the postmistress, that's the schoolmistress, and points the finger the other way. And then the kind of the schoolmistress, who was being played that night by a friend of mine, she's having to manages to kind of escape, like, but it's pretty fraught for her. 2 years later, my friend, who was a schoolmistress, is in the auditorium at Sadler's Wells, waiting for the performance to start, and across the way spots Lynn Gardner and screams like, there's the witch, and like runs across to confront her. And they have this really, joyful, confrontation / reunion. And then like all of that sort of like kind of like, you know, and this conversation between two strangers, essentially, like that happens because like of a particularly vivid memory and moment. Like
I think that's amazing. And I think that's what is really important about your work and maybe all theatre. People sense that, oh, you go to the theatre and really great theatre changes you and you end up different to how you started. But actually the point you're making, and I think is maybe the more true one, is that the change may often happen in the tale and maybe many years away from the lived in moment of experience. But actually all these greatest theatre, particularly if you've been interactive or immersive or all of that, you've sown these seeds. Because if it's going to be a major change or a change of worldview or even this nudge, it isn't that likely to happen in that, you know, moment of half hour or that short reflection. It might happen, but is likely to happen in this tale of reflection, you know, what has changed. Yeah. And that can happen later. And in a way, in a multiplicative, more powerful than it might seem.
Yeah, no, totally. And I think, I mean, two things even from that. I think one, and there's a piece that at the moment we've just presented as both a scratch, but also as a pilot study. Like a pilot research study in collaboration with Bath Spa University, like, and via like an associate of Coney's, Astrid Briel, who's also like postdoc research fellow in Impact. Because Coney's mission now is making play to spark change, and are really like kind of, you know, trying to figure out exactly what happens like kind of with that. And Astrid's being like really key in those conversations and this devising. And the magic trick is kind of like a demonstration in practice, in play, of a broad strokes theory of change through play. Like, in that, you know, if change happens, a result, yeah, what happens? I would say in relation to theatre, that it's taking part that has the more, more likely to provoke impact. Some ways we've all been changed. One of my reasons why people, a lot of people work in theatre, is because they fell in love with how it felt like taking part in theatre, like when they were younger, like probably, you know, school play, youth theatre, community theatre, kind of, etc. That's like, there's a huge, like, and a lot of like the kind of the bigger changes I think kind of come through taking part in it. But anyway, you're within the magic trick. There's a sort of which is a performance, but it's also part of it. You know, the kind of the invitation is to help magic a small change into your life, like for real. And that there's a combination of like play and reflection, like facilitated, that helps people for themselves conjure, slight spoiler, like through the course of it, you'll be surprised to discover and make for yourself a little resolution. So something that will come from reflection over what you've played to that point, and a resolution that you feel could make some impact in your life. And then after that, like, and this is the, you know, it's been the hardest thing to kind of work on and how to kind of figure out. There is a tale, of communications which happens afterwards for maybe hope for a week, but it might take 2 to 3 weeks, with a series of messages exchanged with players that are designed to help support them, like taking that action, and, you know, integrating it into their life, as well as teaching some of the kind of the more sort of both playful, but also I think, you know, importantly, fun and meaningful, tools for kind of reflection and change that the kind of the piece uses. And these are things hopefully that people pick up through just the practice of playing for the kind of for the course of it, and then maybe something that sticks with them. But I think that, yeah, you have to sort of in order to make, to help make a change happen more directly, you have to really focus on how do we facilitate this. And it's still by, you can still see it, that it's pretty much by chance. It's, because the change is going to happen if, from any experience, if I can, something that I'm carrying inside myself happens, the play, it's like striking a rock. Like, you strike it at the right angle and something will split open. And maybe inside, if the rock is opened, maybe there'll be a little nugget of gold, to take a geological metaphor a little bit too far. But maybe not. It's kind of chance at the same time as to whether that's going to meet you at that right moment, as to kind of what comes, and whether it's gold or whether it's just a pretty pattern. With the tools that we've got, everybody really enjoys the magic trick. And, the measures that we've got shows, a positive impact on people's well-being. It's generally kind of quite small, but positive, based on having fun and connecting with different people. That's how usually people talk about it. And then maybe later there'll be a more, slightly more profound change will happen because of what has happened through the tale.
And has there been a pivotal piece of play or theatre which maybe happened years ago and has only more recently caught up with you to spark change, or maybe just something, yourself, or even over the last 20 years, if you think back to, are there some moments of theatre which have really lived with you and have you now think about them differently, or have changed as you've changed?
That's a nice question. I think two things leap into mind. One is a piece by Improbable. I know you were saying earlier that you interviewed Lee Simpson. So maybe that's also priming that sort of called 70 Hill Lane, which was, I think, their first sort of piece that kind of called itself. It was certainly early in their careers. And there's something, I felt like a piece of magic. And it's stayed with me every time I see a fox in the street. I remember that. And I think that there's something I'm still kind of figuring out kind of around. Because it literally felt like magic was happening in the room. And I don't mean that in a kind of elusive, the magic
David,
is done.
Yeah, David Copperfield or something.
There's something. Yeah. And in a way, I'm actually, and then my brain's actually just kind of connecting up to going to see a more recent Improbable piece, The Tower of Glass. They did Manchester International Festival, and then that. Yeah, really feeling like magic, and really feeling like, I mean, it's something where, it was 2 years ago, and that was a year after I'd lost my dad, and feeling, him very present in the room, kind of with me as I was watching it, and how for all kinds of reasons. Anyway, so that's like kind of stayed. There's a very specific thing from a completely different piece that I'm remembering from a piece that actually changed my changed my behavior. It's a beautiful piece that I experienced in Tasmania in the Junction Festival. I was out there making a piece for Coney. This is another piece made by an Australian artist, Thomas Quirk, in collaboration with local teenagers. And the form of the piece, it was called The Pact, and the form of it was that you would go to a cafe in the local department store, typical teenager hangout, and you would sit on a table, like one-on-one with a teenager, in my case, like a kind of, I would say like 16-year-old boy. And we're first of all, like, we don't ever talk like using our voices. We first of all, like, we communicate by passing notes. As I remember, I think on his phone, we just like type stuff up and like pass. And then when we're kind of like ready to play, we both put on headphones and listen simultaneously to a recorded piece by him telling a true story of when he was like a few years younger, like so maybe like 12-13, like his dad had been ill and he'd go to visit him every night in the hospital, and his dad always said never say goodbye, because goodbye means like bye for good, like so only say goodbye when you know it's goodbye. One night boy kind of slipped and said goodbye, but his dad didn't correct him. And then the next day his dad had passed. And I'm feeling the feelings, not least because of my own loss, like a few years ago. And it's extraordinary it's a recording, but he's present with you as you listen to it. It's a really simple, clever device. So you have that connection without the risk of him, it would be really hard for him as a young performer to be telling that story like again and again and again to strangers. It's like, it's a way of kind of catching the impact whilst making it safe. And at the end, I was just invited to make, will you make a pact? Will you make a promise to me of something? It's kind of up to you. And I chose the most obvious thing in that, and I still hold this, like I never say goodbye to somebody unless I know it's for good. Like, always find another way of saying it.
Wow, that's a beautiful story. It recalls, I think someone told me once, they were Spanish and they don't say they don't say adieu in that same way, because you don't want this finality. It's like hasta mañana, as like tomorrow, or a see you later, or some with that. Gosh, yeah, very powerful. Thinking of some of the challenges today and arts and theatre making, I think broadly, very immediately of pandemic and response and building back better. And I also think of climate, two of our sort of biggest challenges. But if I reflect back over the last 20 years, I was trying to explain this to someone who isn't really involved in theatre. And they commented to me that they don't really think they've ever seen a good piece of work on climate. Maybe in the last two or three years there's been a little bit more, but it's kind of interesting that they were suggesting that there hadn't been that much climate work, or maybe climate work that they hadn't been aware of. And there do seem to be particular challenges for climate across all actually industry sectors and companies because of its nature. But I'd be interested to see what you thought about the challenges of climate within theatre, and I can comment with the challenges that I see in climate outside, because it does seem to be particularly challenging for people to grapple with the stories that are meaningful to us. Do you think that's a fair reflection, or do you think maybe there's been more which hasn't perhaps surfaced as much?
I think that's fair. I think it's partly reflects like, the challenge of like conceptualizing like and like making tangible like the climate crisis, and like not least, we are like creatures of story, like, but like, and you know, and you know, we're, you know, in some ways, you know, what is sort of, you know, the kind of conventional like narrative theory can, like, you know, say we're like, you know, the kind of hero's journey kind of, you know, like kind of like, yeah, you know, as one particular, like, is sort of one particular model, like, is like those, that's kind of like how we like to like reflect the world. And that's like, and the climate crisis is almost like completely antithetical to that. It's a systemic challenge, for one. We're really bad at like dealing with systems. And what, also why I think, you know, I mean, games are really interesting in this respect. And obviously, like, you know, fellow collaborator David Finnegan, particular kind of like, you know, interest, expertise, and like, you know, for, because games are, you know, are a systemic approach. All games are systems, even if there are subset of systems that are, you know, balanced and fun to play in a way that, and, you know, and more tangible, and like, kind of give us like feedback, you know, immediate feedback. A good game will always give you that, you know, immediate feedback on like, how am I doing in relation to the objective. But then the climate crisis as a system, you know, is like, it's a hyper object, and it's Timothy Morton's thing. It's too big. It's a system. It's too big for us to imagine. Like, the time span between our actions and then the kind of consequence, like, we're in some ways only right now, tragically, starting to, you know, I think there's maybe a shift over the last couple of years. I've been particularly shaken by the story recently of Lytton, that the small town in Canada, and like what happened there. Like,
you can feel it more viscerally now. Yeah, less, yeah, of a systems. It's there in front of us.
But it's starting to sort of happen in all, you know. But this is the kind of consequence of, in effect, like the lack of a positive response, like, you know, 15, 20, 25 years ago. It's like, you know, we're always like a generation behind in terms of like what we're dealing with. To the time delay. And then also like, it's so big, you know, like, and what, you know, what can an individual do? I mean, like, I mean, and you know, kind of an, theatre often tells stories about, yeah, people, individuals, particular situations, with this kind of question of like, you know, how should I act? Like, feel like, I forget who wrote it, one of the little books of theatre and like theatre and politics, you know, summed it up, you know, in terms of that question, which I think is a great question. But when you're thinking, you know, but actually, as individuals, right now where we're at, the sort of the best things we can do are to try to like activate towards a sort of like, you know, some kind of like systemic, cultural, political like change. That's the level at which change now needs to happen at. And if it, you know, individual action only matters as far as it like, you know, helps that cultural, political shift. Like, so I think it's very difficult, as well as the problems of like, obviously, you know, if you tell people to do things, or you must do things, should do things, there's always that push.
Humans don't really like it. I always remember like the books I was told to read at school, no matter how brilliant, always kind of fall by the wayside in that same thing.
Yeah.
And I guess that's one of my worries about this kind of, how to put it, the kind of Build Back Better movement, or the Build Back Better in the arts movement. I flip-flop on this. I'm currently not feeling that hopeful, actually, because I'm actually seeing stuff not that different. So it hasn't shaken us up perhaps as much, and we're falling back into kind of old patterns, well-worn grooves. So I could see why that you happens.
In terms of like definite inequalities within the sector and like systemic, like,
yeah, I guess all of the old challenges that we have, whether you want to talk about inequality or diversity or funding models or funding full stop, or, you know, being involving people in making art, seeing how how government is valuing art or not, how the system is valuing creativity, all of that. I'm currently actually feeling a little bit down, because I kind of say, well, actually, I'm not seeing the system being nudged that much, even though I do think there's a grassroots kind of call for it. It's it's got lost in a lot of other things, and maybe it's this well-worn groove. I don't assign particular any, you know, this is it. No, there's no particular one individual apportion blame, because there's a system thing which is always undervalued, I think, arts in this way and creativity in this way. But in the kind of Build Back Better, and there's some money and there's some things that I actually don't see it shifting that much differently to before. And I'm, you know, like I've got one foot in, but I don't live the world all the time. So I'm kind of hoping that I'm wrong. Maybe the reflection would be kick me out of my funk, like saying actually no, it's more hopeful, or maybe just catalyze it to saying no, actually you might be right on some things. You gotta kick some bums. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, partly, I think all the things. I think that like there is some shift that is happening. Like I hope some shift is happening. Like I know what Coney is striving to do, and you know, we're definitely moving in the right direction. There's also like still a lot of work to be done, and like where, you know, if we're moving fast enough, I don't know. Like I think that it's, and there's, yeah, there's other organizations like, you know, moving faster and better for sure, like, but I think, I mean, certainly in terms of like, you know, diversity and inclusion, I think there's certainly a kind of hope, a kind of like at least now a shared understanding of like what, yeah, the what is the necessary direction of travel, like how far people can get along with that. I don't know. I think that there is a, in some ways, I think it's a broader question. You know, theatre will always like hold itself to account and examine itself as a sector, but in some ways, it's a much broader issue.
It kind of reflects society. Theatre might be at one edge of it, but it reflects broadly where it comes from.
Yeah, and we are like, yeah, you know, because I think certainly in kind of in terms of sort of the how, you know, freelancers have been impacted, like, you know, disproportionately, it's definitely true. But I, you know, one of the sort of the, you know, in some ways it's, you know, society-wide solutions are also like, you know, part, you know, whether that a universal basic income, like that feels like almost in a way like the kind of the singular best solution. And I've also kind of been struck by how, like, I mean, I think the sort of the informal decision-making structures, you know, that happen in terms of like where the next jobs like kind of come from, which are kind of informal and invisible and therefore prone to like all of the kind of like the kind of the systemic biases, but have also actually sustained, like, I've kind of often wondered whether it's like the amount of like people who are, you know, supported as freelancers, like if you were to take all of the work and actually build a structure which was kind of giving like more stable like job opportunities, like to support people within the kind of the system as it is and the sector as it is, like actually you might find that is a, you know, almost by definition a far smaller proportion than the people who would like, you might end up like, you know, employing 20% of the freelancers on a more sustained, some more sustained supported basis, and the other 80% would be left out. Like, I don't know. Like, it feels like a lot, you know, a lot of people, because of the informality of the kind of the way that opportunities arise, because of the invisibility of decision-making structures, I think more people potentially like float around with hope that something will come than actually what can sector with its current level of resource, what could it actually support? I don't know. Like, but it makes me sort of feel that in terms of that particular like dynamic, that there's kind of whether incremental change from within is ever going to like make the difference, and whether it's the sector by itself so much as like figuring out for the whole of it's difficult. And it's, yeah,
well, maybe turning to last couple of questions on maybe advice and process, I was wondering, reflecting on your work, what does a good week or good day of creativity look like for you? Or you could talk, I guess, you know, because a week of theatre could actually have rehearsal as well as research as well as making. So, you know, there could be a lot in that. But, you know, at its very best, what does a good creative process or day or week kind of feel like, or good or you know, what you aspire to, like, okay, that's been some great creating work?
I mean the work I did for Coney is, like, in some ways, like, the creative process is a relatively small part of that, like, what it is in terms of, like, you know, the kind of the you know, running the company and, like, and the business of that, and, like, you know, taking care of, like, of team and, like, checking in with people, like, and as well as, like, you know, the kind of, like, conversations and chats, like, out with people outside the company, like, that all feels it's much bigger than just kind of what that kind of that creative process might be. It also feels really important. I feel like it's been really nice. Coney sort of shifted a little bit in sort of defining the way that we're kind of, like, you know, our closest, you know, we are a network of, like, of makers that we kind of reassemble teams from, and trying to define the inner rings of that network as kind of Guild and Associates, and being around a kind of an active exchange of practice, and, you know, and by exchanging practice, like, everybody like benefits, like, and I feel that benefit myself, like, in that exchange and the different conversations with different people over the course of it. And hopefully that's also, you know, something that, you know, Coney will, you know, freely offer to, you know, I will have a virtual cuppa with anybody who asks if I've got time to do it. Feel that's kind of one of the responsibilities from being funded in the sector. And it's like, but it's a mutual benefit, it should be. So that's part of it, I guess.
Yeah. Like, fertilizing a lot of other ideas and people, yeah, and being part of that ecosystem.
A lot of work will be made out of, like, you know, kind of, you know, in some ways be sparked by the possibilities that particular collaborations, like, might offer. And then, yeah, I think, I mean, and this is a lot to do with the kind of work that Coney makes, like, because it's like, it's not sort of, often it's only when you get a playing audience that you know what it is. And, you know, like, a play test, like, is like the equivalent of a rehearsal in many ways. Like, you know, Small Town, when we made it, like, the first R&D week that we had at the National Studio, like, yeah, we had a week, and we opened the doors to audience on the middle of day two, like, and then like, you know, did as many, like, different, like, playtests as we possibly could over the kind of course of that week. That was a rehearsal process. That was pretty joyful. I think, yeah, but often we're kind of, it's more like devising, it's more kind of like kind of creative conversations so that get people to a point where everybody can then kind of like separate and go off and make the different elements and then bring them back together ready to be played again. And I've within that, and also it's to do with, like, with Zoom, like, as we're, you know, largely operating at the moment, I find that, like, doing that kind of work for no more than 4 hours a day. So even if you're like, we made a piece last summer, The Delegation, that was a collaboration with a Russian theatre festival and Russian performers, you know, and that, yeah, they're, you know, we're kind of devising and kind of rehearsing, but we didn't work for more than 4 hours a day, like, together, and having that breathing space to then take thoughts away, do some writing, do some, you know, other thinking, and, like, and trying to, like, you know, design, like, kind of interactive structures that you can come back in and play. And then, those 4 hours, the more that could be us playing, and, you know, trying things out, and with time later, like, to reflect on it, that always feels like a nice process. You kind of, you know, in a way, like, you know, however you can do it, spend the least amount of time talking, otherwise, like, coming out of stuff, you know, the faster you can make something that you can play, and then, like, start to sort of, like, yeah, sort of, it's always iterative, and it's always like sort of sculpting it according to what you learn from how that plays, and yeah, everybody having fun, yeah, like,
spend time playing, having fun.
Yeah, basically. But also that I think, you know, the fun the more, it's one of, I mean, I think the sort of the more fun we have together, like in the room, in terms, and I mean, genuinely, like, and everybody feeling fulfilled and safe and like, and able to sort of kind of like, express their own kind of creative agency kind of in that, then that, I think more often than not, translates into quality to the work for an audience that, you know, is like tangible and like, and makes it, part of what makes it good.
That's definitely one of the things I learned from your work, or particularly your work with De Koven, that actually fun as a huge basis, not maybe quite as how we thought of fun when we were five or six, although there's elements of it, but what actually fun really means is central to the creative process. Great. Yeah. So maybe last question would be, what advice or thoughts might you have to young creatives or theatre makers, or maybe not so young, just theatre makers or creatives in general, people setting out on their journeys or resetting out as we emerge from this period?
Yeah, I think it depends how you want to like formulate this, like having like considering that your career will be a portfolio of different bits of work, or like resisting anything which means that you end up identifying and defining yourself by something. So like, I can only be an actor if I'm acting, I can only be a director if I'm directing. That's like, it's a really hard place to kind of get out of if you fall into that, like, and I think like being able to have a portfolio and said like, this is, and like inside that definitely having like space for, this is work that I make for myself, whether it's collaborating with anybody else or not, but I'm even if it's like one tiny thing that you do for 10 minutes every month, but that this is just mine. I think that's really important to have that space. But also to sort of like, I was supported for a while. I attempted as a medical secretary. And it wasn't that job gave me anything specifically that fed into the work, but it gave me space. What our sidelines are and our side hustles, I think are kind of actually really important to sort of like, also like value. And like, I'm going to give like, and so that we're not defining in that way. I think that's, and the great thing about like doing things, having a little bit of space where you're making something for yourself, is that you hopefully cut something away from that. What I see, and I feel lucky that I managed to largely dodge by kind of realizing I didn't want to be like a theater director directing plays, was also like, the sense in which each job becomes, if every job becomes that the kind of the opportunity to get the next job, then, and you're always looking to like go to please somebody else in everything that you do, I think that can lead to like, kind of really difficult like trajectories, and also potentially a sense of competition where actually everybody that you know who's in this field as well, like should be friends and collaborators. Like it's kind of, that's definitely the best way to kind of like to approach it. Everybody's successful work by one. Success like is made by scenes, and and work is made by more of a scene than it is by any individuals. Like, and then I think the other, maybe this is even the biggest thing, is kind of, it's just being able to kind of constantly be like reflecting on your own practice and like, what is distinctive about what I do? Like, where does what I do like fits into the bigger kind of ecosystem? And like, and how do I distinguish my work from other people's, like in terms of like what I'm most interested in or what I'm most specialized in? And that, I remember like years ago having an argument in the pub with Dominic Drumgool, then like artistic director of the Globe, and then I was quite rude to him because he'd written some articles that were, to be honest, a bit offensive, like, but we had a good argument, and then he was like, oh yeah, come and have a meeting, like, let's continue. And then ended up talking about what was like very early Coney at that point for about 3 hours, and really exciting conversation, really challenging. But, you know, he didn't really understand much other than what I was saying, but really, you know, very smart, fed in kind of beautifully. And we kind of left with, okay, there's nothing really directly here between, you know, the nascent Coney and the Globe, but it's been a great conversation. And I'm leaving and I'm like, shit, you know, I'm also like, you know, I kind of, you know, at least used to direct plays, and I genuinely really love like Shakespeare and verse text, and I love the Globe. So I was like, oh yeah, sorry, I should also like sort of say I'm also interested in this. And he said something which at the time felt really like crushing, but actually I think it's one of the best things anybody's ever given me. It was like, I meet hundreds of people a month, literally, who are interested in directing like verse text. You're the first person I've met that's interested in doing the thing that you spent 3 hours telling me about. I reckon you should stick with that. And I it was like, yeah. But actually, you know, it took a little bit. It's one of the best
people I've
been given.
What's
distinctive? How do you distinguish yourself? I like that as a sort of the... And that's always, that's an ongoing reflection. Like, so you know, my answer to that question now is different and more specific in a way than it was like
has evolved. Yeah, that seems a really good reflection to have. What's unique about your own practice or how it's evolving, and therefore polishing up that. And maybe if you've got a decision, you go with your uniqueness as opposed to that path or rut well traveled.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's an excellent thought to end on. So Tassos, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
If you appreciate the show, please like and subscribe, as it helps others find the podcast.